Well, great. Since I will just say I have the same thanks and appreciation for the colleagues at this table and Anna and everyone else at the Men's Health Caucus and the who have supported and who actually have asked us to come. So these are the four things that we'll go over. Really brief Title 10. Some people are familiar with it. Some people aren't. We're a relatively small program, but we cause a lot of trouble. And I smile because I like doing that every now and then. So. So first, what's the Title X program? And some, I always know when we have new people in the office and they call it Title X, and they just whisper, it's 10, as in the Roman numeral, like, oh, okay. So we are the nation's family planning program. I mean, we're there to provide grants to public and non-private organizations for family planning and related preventive health services. And I talk about this related preventive health services. Prior to a certain administration, we used to always say just family planning. Because it made sense and people got it. And then for political reasons, we talked about related preventive health services. And then it stuck because it made sense. We do a lot more than provide contraception and make develop or have access to contraception. So it was a good thing that came out. So the mission of the program is really to provide individuals with information and the means to exercise personal choice, freely determine the number and spacing of their children. We're funded through a HRSA appropriation. Think back about 20 years, we used to be out of HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, but currently are managed by the Office of Population Affairs, which falls under the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, who was Howard Koh, who accepted President Obama's award. And again, to make things even more difficult, we're actually regionally administered through the 10 regional offices within the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health. So what we also want to do is just make sure that part of this is ensuring that the program provides access to a broad range of acceptable and effective family planning methods and related preventive health services. And so we'll talk about what that actually means for men, because we want to make sure that we acknowledge that women, this program, though sponsored in 1970 by, sponsored by H.W. Bush, enacted by Nixon, was actually always put in there that men and women would both be served. So there was some forethought there. So what do we support? We do a little bit more than what Medicaid does. We actually identify ourselves as a payer of last resort. We don't reimburse services. We actually pay directly for services. And some of those include staff, rent, equipment, supplies, actually counseling. It's very difficult to code counseling, but we do pay for that time. Lab test, training, which is another big thing. Medical and social service referrals. But despite what the public may want to think, no funds can be used to support abortion services. Our dollars are not fungible. You can see our appropriation is just under $300 million. It sounds like a lot, but it goes pretty quickly. This 90% of appropriated funds being used to support clinical family planning services, it's actually called report language. We can stick with it or we don't have to stick with it, and this is kind of the wonky side. It's one of those things, it's in report language, it's a should, but it kind of acts like a shall. So we've always put 90% of that appropriation directly to clinical services. So these are the provisions of the law, and so this is telling us what we have to do. Section 1001 is really the big one. Those are our direct clinical services. Training, research, and information education all support and all need to support these services. We'll really focus on research in the presentation, but I want to hit on training. We just made a big training change for the U.S. We used to have 10 regional training centers. I see a couple people shaking their heads. And you can grab me after and I'll tell you that no need to worry. And if not, I'll direct you at some of my Cardia colleagues who are in support, and a JSI colleague as well. So our training actually went from 10 regional training centers and 3 national training centers, one of which was a male training center, down to 5 national training centers. Part of the attempt is, one, to consolidate and to become more efficient. There was a lot of redundancy. At the same time, it was also a way that the office could develop its own identity and really talk about and do what we all know that we've been doing. One is to be a leader and the department's go-to for family planning and population health. At the same time, we've had incredible trainers in our training system, our regional training centers, and those colleagues who've been providing wonderful work, evidence-based, and they're experts in the field. And that by consolidating this and kind of turning it into one national training center, a large national system, that We are providing not only the Title X service providers, but also those in the government and in private sector opportunity and resources, as well as also be able to funnel their resources in so that we're providing health services to all in a better way. Threw in the abortion just to see, to let everyone know that it's in there. So again, this is my much smaller org chart. And on the right side, you see the ten different regions. So our office is headed by a political appointee, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Population Affairs, referred to as a DASPA. Sue Muskoski was actually the former director of the Office of Family Planning, now is actually the Deputy Director of the Office of Population Affairs. We have research evaluation on one end, and then we have staff and the program operations on the other. So what do we look like? So in 2001, this is actually what our, and these are preliminary data, and so this is actually what we look at. We have about 98 grantees. When we break it out, we have several different health departments, Planned Parenthoods, FQHCs, and CHCs, and then 20%, give or take, other, either individual grantees, family planning councils, et cetera. The things that we really want to highlight is, one, not only just the number, so this adds the complexity of kind of how services are delivered. 4,400 service sites is very difficult to maintain and also capture each day. Every month we kind of have an idea, but we have clinical service sites that kind of go in and out on a monthly and or unfortunately daily basis. Forget really the number of clients, but the proportion of clients. We've actually increased males from 2% to about 8% over the past 10 years. And the actual numbers continue to grow. Who do we serve? We serve youth. We serve a lot of young people. And most importantly, just under 90%, historically we're usually at 90%, are at or below 200% of poverty. So again, they're low income, disproportionately female, disproportionately ethnic, for ethnic backgrounds, as well as look at the uninsurance. So 64% are actually uninsured. And then we can kind of go into what that means. And, so we also have about a quarter that have public health insurance. So, again, trying to zip through this real quick, just talked about kind of the what they look like, and also the add to the complexity, the range in grantee funding amount. So we have some grantees, or one grantee that gets right around $165,000, and one very large grantee that gets $21 million. And then there's everyone in between. So it's a challenging program as far as operationalizing things. At the same time, it's for those that are family planning providers, you all do an incredible work to try to negotiate not only the political, but also the lack of funding that's out there. So let's get into the real good stuff, the exciting stuff for me. The male reproductive health initiative. It started several years ago, just before slightly before I got there. And there really were some large goals. One was we needed to think about what was worth it. How are we going to use our money effectively, especially when we have to, despite what many people think, when we actually do a spending plan, there's someone who actually looks at it and cares what we spend our money on. At least I can say that for us. I don't know about some other departments. But one is we had to increase the number of family planning services, the number of males. We needed to get that up. That was really kind of what we were aiming for, as well as increase the number and type of services offered to males. So it wasn't just seeing twice as many men now for something. It was making sure that we provided a broad range of services and those that they needed, not those that we wanted to give them. And then thinking long term, we know that we needed to eventually develop a list of what these services for males was. What are these categories? How did it look like? How was it delivered? Develop and document strategies, successful strategies for providing these services to men. And then also taking one more step and developing some guidance, and processes for how to implement these services. So we'll talk again a little bit more about that. But to be honest, we also have to be considerate of what are the other things that are there. It's not a zero-sum game. And my colleague, Dr. Fine, and Sarah Goldenkrantz right next to her have been doing some great work. And that's the one thing that we always talked about. We want to see more men. We're not going to give you any more money. That means that women are not going to receive the services that they need. And I'm certainly an advocate for that. I understand that. If we see one less female because we're seeing men, we need to be considerate about what the impact of that is. And so the main consideration was to maintain or even increase the number of female clients. How is that possible without money? We'll talk about that. Most importantly, make sure that if we're if you're going to add a new population or focus on that, you're going to have to address quality of services. And you're most likely going to have to improve services for, in this case, the men. So why wouldn't you increase it for the women? So again, being mindful about that as well. And also, overall, we wanted to make sure that contraceptive method choice, whatever it is, we're increasing adherence to that. So round one, 5 years for it. It was really to get the money out to really talk about this and make sure that people were aware of the importance of addressing men's health. Very little finding as far as that. It was kind of, we got money out to CBOs, NGOs, some of the smaller agencies. But what we did found is we identified barriers to providing family planning services. Whether or not it was as simple as men didn't know that they could go to a women's health service center, I mean, I don't think that's unreasonable. Women, you know, clinicians didn't want to see men. Somewhat reasonable. Not acceptable, but reasonable, I thought. So there were some of these things as far as access. So in round two, we learned a lot. We wanted to develop something that was curriculum-based and or had a logic model, something that was structured, a structured approach. So we put out the announcement, and we got back and awarded 15 grantees. About five of them were clinic-based, and so they weren't an educational model. The rest were educational models, which all were based off of the Wise Guys curriculum. Many people are probably familiar with Wise Guys. Actually, the Family Life Council was one of our grantees. However, the challenging part about that was of the 10 that used the Wise Guys program, the Wise Guys Family Life Council was the only one who adhered directly to their curriculum, which for the evaluators understand that it's really difficult to evaluate a program when you don't stick to the curriculum, which was slightly difficult. However, we learned some things. One was the clinic-based interventions, at least for us, for the target populations, they really focused on actually getting guys into the clinic. That was their focus, and it was pretty good. For the educational ones, it was difficult. You were providing, you know, knowledge, trying to change, increase knowledge, trying to address attitudes, and then hopefully work on behaviors. And making the connection even to behaviors is difficult. Getting them into the clinic was even more difficult. So, you know, it was very difficult, as you see in the last day. So these are the three that kind of stand out. Young Men's Clinic increased clients significantly. Obviously, they focus on men, but outside their door is actually the Women's Family Planning Center. They actually were able to implement and replicate a three-stage implementation which collaborated and worked with a workforce program that was very near them. And so, again, three stages aren't supposed to work, are they? I mean, what can you learn in three stages? Well, there's significant, statistically significant results. And again, mirror the same results in Baltimore with the same model. City of Minneapolis, one of the favorite ones that we have, because when I say on-location STI testing, it meant urine-based testing in the parks. So you had guys walking around with empty cups and then bags with full urine. Well, most of the clients were either in the non-traditional work setting. They were drug dealers. So the police were already skeptical. And then they were even more skeptical when guys were walking around, and women. I would say the best health educator that they had out there was a woman. She was fantastic. What do you do when you got a... How do you explain to a police officer coming from a park where drug dealing is and negotiation is going on, as well as probably some other things, you got a bag of urine? That's a tough one to sell. So it was one from dropping in. Either way, they worked out. They got some negotiation with the police. Police department understood who they were. And it's a message to make sure that these are things you don't think about until you're there and a cop's chasing you. So simple things. Talk with the police officer. Let them know what you're doing. Let your community know what you're doing. Worked out great. Now, not to say that they completely reduced chlamydia rate through us, even though I'd like to think that, that along with some of the other initiatives that they had throughout the city, there was a gradual decrease in chlamydia rates, which they actually had one of the highest in the country at the time. And so finally, the Planned Parenthood of South Texas now is the Men's and Women's Health Services. This is actually this three-stage intervention. They address the environment, all in a systematic approach, training, and also outreach. And outreach is kind of paraphrased because it was a lot more about clinic promotion. They saw, and this is the big and, the important piece. By increasing males, they saw a significant, about, was it 20%? Almost 30% in women. How did that happen? Well, one, men have revenue, and they can bring in revenue to the clinic. The other thing was something that we call inreach. Well, you're at a family planning clinic that provides a significant amount of services to women. If it's family planning, Regardless if there are women who have female partners or male partners, family planning, you kind of need a male someplace. The women either knew a male, had a partner who was a male, father, etc. So we use this inReach. We use the clients that you already had to get these numbers in, and therefore it went along. So whether or not the female who was bringing in her partner may have been a friend who had a female partner, and so it evolved. So it was really good stuff. Again, so we use that as a jumping point for this current round that we're in. Again, big goal was really to increase the number. We have 5 locations, multiple sites at each location. We use this 3-stage systematic approach. And the early findings, and Dr. Fine will be presenting later this afternoon, so he has actually some numbers. I didn't want to steal your flavor. You got some good flavor. It's good stuff, Dave. And one is what we saw the increase in males and females. Also saw an increase in number of STI screening, so both chlamydia and gonorrhea, as well as HIV tests among men. And actually, there was also a decrease in positivity among chlamydia and gonorrhea. So what does this mean? How can we take these learnings and bring them to where you are to inform those that that are interested in it? So excuse the grammar. So there's some easy stage or there's some challenging things, and there's some hard-er things. So one, obviously, what do you do? Focus on what you do and make sure you do it well before you start doing something else. The programs that we had started doing things that they wanted to do but hadn't excelled in what their primary mission was, and that was an issue because doing 2 things so-so is much worse than doing 1 thing really good even though you want to do another one. So focus on what it is. Be patient. It's gradual implementation. You have to have a plan. All staff is important, and we'll talk about that again a little bit as we go. I think I'm skirting time real quick. And who is it that you actually want to serve? Not just men. What type of males? Who are these men? This is the challenging part. It's really you need to develop some measures. You need to use these measures to assess your performance, and you need to evaluate what you're doing. We all kind of get these. These are very easy things. One thing that I want to address, though, is cost. How much does it cost to implement the program you're going to do? How much does it cost to operate it? And what is the return? There are many things that you need to go to your board or you need to go to whoever's funding you to say, this is worth it. Yeah, it's worth it because men and women are becoming healthier. But what does that mean? Doesn't mean so much if the clinic itself is out, if you only survive a year. So you have to think smart about this. And then also assess readiness. Where are you for the infrastructure? Where's your staff? Attitudes, and both the administrative and your clinical stuff. The harder piece, you got to be out there all the time. And why I said there wasn't as much outreach, outreach is kind of fun. Outreach is the fun stuff. When you get a good outreach worker, you're out there, they're beating the pavement. And it's not necessarily outreach, because you also have to outreach, but bring them into the clinic. Often, there's a big gap between outreach activities and services that are provided. Handing out 1,000 condoms doesn't mean you saw 1,000 people. It just means you started with 2,000 and you ended up with 1,000, and you got 1,000. Are they using it? Are they not? The important piece is really kind of increasing efficacy of whoever your clients are so that, one, if you hand them out, that they're using it, that they can come to a safe place, and that's where the clinics are. Wants versus needs. We all love needs assessments, but often they're wants assessments, and they're really not what we need to know to find out who these people are. And then finally, where are your males? Physically, behaviorally, do they want to come to the clinic or not? So I think I'm at almost my last minute. I think I'm probably at my last minute. Let's talk about actually what are some of these. That was very general. What are some of these things? So what are the attitudes, experiences, and concerns that your staff has? So we think about, what does that mean? One of the big things to have buy-in was to address your staff needs. Some of our staff, and I say this in it, really some of the Title X providers, didn't want to see males. They weren't there to provide services to males. They were there to provide services to low-income women back in the 70s. That was why they were there. Well, what did that really mean? When we think about it, there was a lot of things that came up. So we did some training. What were their interactions with men? Many of these low-income women that came in probably weren't in the most positive environments with their male partner. That affects practitioners. What was their relationship with their fathers, their brothers, their husbands, their sons, their friends? These are the things that were very difficult to kind of grasp. And so one of the areas is Wayne Pulowski did a training. He used to work with Planned Parenthood of PPFA. And he did the first training for men that were accompanying their female partners at abortion clinics. Did his focus group, you know, they're men there, you know, why aren't we talking to them? Does a focus group, comes back, talks to his staff, asks the staff, what do you think the first question was? Well, they said, they probably want to know when they can have sex with their partner. He said, absolutely, that was the first question. Oh, you knew it, that was horrible. Yeah, that's just all they want to do. And they said, no, you don't need to know why. One was because they cared about their partner. When was a good time to have sex with your partner after an abortion? When were they ready? You didn't want to have it too soon because you didn't want to feel pushy. At the same time, you didn't want to last too long or wait too long because you didn't want her to think that you didn't find her attractive anymore. So these were some of the things that were in the male's mind that the practitioners weren't aware of. So it's, again, stepping back, considering what your practitioners and what are the clinicians' attitudes about those that they're serving, especially when they're a new population. Environmental. It's a much more than a can of paint in Ladies Home Journal. So it's not just magazines and colors, but intake forms. Take a look at your intake forms. What do they look like? What's your signage? Is it the Women's Health Center? Not to say you have to change the sign, but just being aware of that. Anatomy posters. Are there any anatomy posters with a penis out there in your clinics? It's important, especially your intake form. Where am I supposed to circle if my right testy hurts, if there's no testes on the diagram of the intake form? Again, things to be aware of. And also capacity assessment. You have to know, if you're going to have these new guys come in, these new people come in, your clinic flow is going to be adjusted, you're going to have to reschedule, and billing's going to change a little bit. And finally, probably the most important piece along with, they're all equally important, but there's different areas, is make sure you develop relationships with other agencies. Work on the schools in educational development areas. Work on employment centers. Work with the Justice Department and the justice system. A lot of the individuals that you're going to see as males and that we saw as males were low income, either in and out, or somehow have been touched by the Justice Department, either mostly negatively, and not touch, but maybe some of them have been touched. Child support enforcement was huge. And it's become much more positive. It's not a punitive child support enforcement field out there anymore. Something to look toward as far as how to recruit. Maternal and child health and fatherhood initiatives are also very, very big. So I think I have completely gone way past my time. But, you know, some of these things are, again, how to adjust the ACA and what you need to think about. But these are some of the areas that give us opportunity. The ACA, there's only so much you can know about it right now, but there's a lot you can think about. At the same time, need to be at least planning for increase in demand, which you need to have infrastructure that's ready to serve. Don't serve clients if you're not ready, because you can have a whole bunch of yeses, you did a great job, but when you have that one no, I had a horrible experience, finished. Maybe not finished, and you can rework it, but it's much more difficult. So be patient about this. Use the passion, but also make sure when your passion is out there that you're guiding it toward a goal. Not just screaming out there, we need X, we need Y, we need Z. We need these things, and I'm going to put you on the spot again, David, because I love using this quote. This relates to U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Some of the things, why do they give self-testicular exams an I? Why did they give PSAs a D? Why did they give mammography a D? We need more data. We need more questions. We need more research, one. You need to ask the right questions. You need to ask the right questions more often, and you need more better data. I told you I'd get it in there, which is grammatically correct. I've actually been thinking about that a lot. But so these are some things that you really need to ask. We need more questions. We need the right questions asked. How is a PSA test a bad thing? It's not, but we don't have anything to support it. Just because I think so, what does that mean? That's my opinion. So just to be mindful of those. So I don't know if we have questions, but I'll be here for a while. Thanks again. I really appreciate it. Sorry you had to listen to me for much longer than you all anticipated. So thanks again.
On behalf of the Men's Health Caucus, I'd like to thank all of you for coming. Our three speakers, divided in two. We have maybe 3 or 4 minutes for questions. I don't have to run off. I don't know if Scott or David do, but please feel free to ask questions, and we'll call it a session at noon time. Yes, ma'am.
A lot of families have traditionally been staffed by either women's health practitioners or OBGYNs, more licensed to much for them, both financial and food. Is it okay for me to help you deal with that?
Yeah, so the current slash, there are no cost extension mail training center looked into that. So there are a lot of options of providing these services to males. You had a women's mental health practitioner. Last time I saw a male was probably when they were getting their RN, which there were a lot of things with that. One is, legally, could they see men? And so we went back and forth about that. It really depends on the state support, and then the national level support. So there's actually a document that we're vetting to make sure it's there, but addressing state by state, the clinic, what state you're in, and what your degree is in, who you can see. But that's one of the areas that we need to make sure that one, you can do it, and two, part of the resistance is to see males by their family and practitioners or women's health practitioners. Folks that they didn't want to do, they just had. And so if they wanted to make sure if they were going to do it, they knew how to do it. So there was that educational piece that they needed to make sure that they had, not that.
Scott, I remember you mentioned that Men's Health Network is looking at certification in men's health services program. I hope that happens. I think it's necessary. A lot of people call themselves men's health practitioners and really aren't. Is reproductive health an area that you're thinking of looking at and certifying to help out with an obvious bureaucratic impediment?
Yep. The short answer is absolutely. It actually comes from requests from many folks that are actually operating in the male family planning or family planning space. So a lot of these reproductive health practitioners are actually asking for it. They want the experience. They want to understand more how to do better outreach and education awareness in the local community. So it's actually coming as a result of them asking for it.
Excellent. Yes, ma'am. Yes. That's an exceptional comment, and really it is, I think, the weight of looking to do more evidence-based practice and evidence-based guidelines helps facilitate that. And where you draw the line, of course, is always a judgment by a clinician when they're face-to-face with a patient. And from my perspective, that's probably the best place to make those decisions in the context of compassionate as well as cost-effective care. So you're absolutely right. We need to learn the lessons and use that evidence to guide decision-making.
Yeah,